Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Although the percentage of food insecure households in the U.S. is down from a high of almost 15% in 2011, the level has remained steady at about 14% since 2013. And of the 50 states, Ohio ranks third in the percentage of households in which meals are skipped or skimped to make ends meet. Those are a few of the conclusions of a report issued in early September on household food security by the United States Department of Agriculture. Coming up, we'll hear about innovations at the Mid-Ohio Food Bank to meet the needs and about the expansion of the Worthington Resource Pantry, which started in 2008, serving just 12 families a month, and in 2014 was up to 1,000 families a year. Joining us now by phone is the lead author of the USDA report, social scientist Alicia Coleman Jensen. Welcome to the show, Alicia.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
And also Executive Director of the Ohio Association of Food Banks, Lisa Hamler-Fugit. Welcome back.
Good morning, Ann.
So, Alicia Coleman Jensen, tell us what we mean by food insecure.
Sure. Food insecurity refers to the percentage of U.S. households that had difficulty putting enough food on the table. The technical definition is that households at some time during the year, we're unable to provide adequate quantity or quality of food for one or more household members due to a lack of resources.
And what data are you using to get these numbers?
The data we use comes from the current population survey, and that also is the source for other federal statistics, such as the unemployment rate and the poverty rate. The Economic Research Service of USDA sponsors the survey, and the Census Bureau conducts the survey. And it's a high-quality federal survey, as I said. It's a source for other federal statistics as well.
What kind of questions do you ask to get this information? What exactly are we asking of people?
We ask household respondents a series of 18 questions. 10 of those questions refer to adults in the household. And in households with children, there's an additional 8 questions about food insecurity among children. And the questions really range in severity. So the first sort of least severe question we ask about is whether the household worried about running out of food before they got money to buy more. Some other questions ask about being able to afford balanced meals, eating less than you felt you should because there wasn't enough money for food, ever cutting the size of meals or skipping meals. And the most severe item for adults is, did you or other adults in your household ever not eat for a whole day because there wasn't enough money for food? And we ask similar types of questions about children in the household as well.
Food insecurity is on the rise in Ohio while declining nationally. That was of note from this report. Was Ohio alone in that category?
Well, so Ohio, the prevalence of food insecurity in Ohio and across the nation has increased from the previous 10-year period studies. Mm-hmm. So just to back up a little bit, our state-level food insecurity estimates are based on 3 years of data. And we use 3 years of data from 2012 to 2014 just to ensure that we have enough data to get reliable estimates for all the states. And compared to the previous 10-year period, 2002 through 2004, food insecurity in Ohio was up 5.5 percentage points. And nationally, during that same period, the national food insecurity rate was up 2.9 percentage points. So across the country, from that 10-year period, we saw an increase in food insecurity, and we saw a little bit more of an increase in Ohio during that time.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about household food security in the United States, and more specifically in Ohio in 2014. I'm talking with Alicia Coleman Jensen. She was the lead author of the report from the United States Department of Agriculture's Economic Research Service. Also with me, Lisa Hamler-Fugit of the Ohio Association of Food Banks. Lisa Hamler-Fugit, was this a surprise or did this substantiate what you suspected?
It confirms what we really see every day in at our food banks, food pantries, and soup kitchens. That, in fact, it also confirmed what we found in Hunger in Ohio study. that reported that we've seen a 40% increase since 2010. Over 1 in 6 Ohioans are now turning to an emergency food provider. And in fact, the dependence on emergency food due to a number of factors, we now have 6 in 10 households reporting that they're turning on a regular basis to supplement low incomes in order to keep food on their table. So again, it continues to confirm what we see every day in throughout the state of Ohio.
Alicia Coleman-Jensen, when I looked at the statistics, and correct me if I'm wrong, of course, but I saw that the percentage of households with very low food security hasn't changed much. It remains at 5.6%. What does this mean? What is the significance?
You're right. The prevalence of very low food security has been unchanged over the last few years. We've seen a decline in food insecurity overall, mm-hmm. As you noted, from 2011 through 2014. And the overall food insecurity rate includes this subset of very low food security. Very low food security is the more severe range of food insecurity where people are telling us they're just not getting enough to eat because they lack enough money for food. So the decline that we've seen within the overall food insecurity rate has primarily been in the low food security rate, which is more typified by reduced quality and variety of meals rather than inadequate intake. So we've seen a reduction in the relatively less severe food insecurity category rather than the more severe category.
And what do we know about the people, the families that fall into that low food security category? What else do we know about them?
Well, we know overall that food insecurity, low food security and very low food security tends to be higher in households with disabled adults. It tends to be higher in low-income households, as you may suspect, both in poverty. We see higher food insecurity rates in the households headed by single parents versus married couple parents. And we see higher food insecurity rates in households with children than in the overall population.
And how many children are we talking about here?
In 2014, the prevalence of food insecurity in households with children was 19.2%. And in these households, as I mentioned earlier, we asked questions about food insecurity among both adults and among children. And so we separate where we see food insecurity among adults only, where parents tell us that they've had a reduction in intake or poor dietary quality, but their children have not. And we see that's about half of those food insecure households with children. So overall, we have an overall food insecurity rate of about 20%, 19.2% of households with children are food insecure. Mm-hmm. And within that, about half of those, 9.8%, had food insecurity only among adults. So in the rest, 9.4% of households with children, we see food insecurity among children and adults. So in those households, children are having reductions in dietary quality or variety. And in more severe situations, children are not getting enough to eat. And that category of very low food security affected 1.1% of households with children. And in that category, parents reported that children were skipping meals or not getting enough to eat due to a lack of resources.
Lisa Hamler, for people who are just joining us, we're talking about food insecurity. We're talking about how there's been an uptick in the low, very low food security category in the state of Ohio. Why in the world? I mean, we keep hearing about how great Ohio is doing economically, how we're only about 25,000 jobs short of getting back to where we were back in 2008 before the Great Recession. What's happening here?
Well, the jobs that have come back don't provide livable wages, family-supporting wages. They tend to be part-time, temporary, contingent. Certainly, we are looking forward to seeing the revised census data that comes out tomorrow, the American Community Survey data that comes out on Thursday that will really start to tell us what do medium incomes look like. But again, it's, you know, those family supporting jobs just have not returned. And in a service sector based economy, it's the workers who are really subject to whether the sales are there. And I think this is a real new phenomena that we're seeing is, despite the fact that you may be on the schedule for full time, if you work for employers that are dependent on sales, if the sales aren't there, you're being sent home. We're seeing more workers that are on an on-call basis. And certainly the Economic Research Service also noted the number of households who they want to be working full time, but they're not. It's part time. And then they're having to also depend on other supplemental, both public as well as private sector resources to make ends meet. But I also want to note that I think one of the most startling facts of the study that came out is Ohio's very low food insecurity rate is now 7.5%. It tied us for third in the nation, only behind Louisiana and Missouri. And
Arkansas and Missouri.
Arkansas and Missouri. We're tied with Maine. To give you some context on this, this study's been done for nearly 20 years, mm-hmm. so it's a really good benchmark for us to go back and compare to. And Ohio's very low food security rate in the period of 1996 to 1998 was 3.5%. So we're headed in the wrong direction, both in food insecurity as well as very low food insecurity.
What about – I've read that there are fewer the food stamp program in Ohio was contracted. They reduced the number of people that could receive food stamps in Ohio. What happened there and why?
Well, beginning in November of 2013, all food stamp recipients in the state of Ohio experienced a cut in their benefits. It was a rollback from the modest boost provided through the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act. The state did implement time limits for certain populations of unemployed or underemployed adults without dependents between the ages of 18 and 50 to 3 months of food stamp benefits in every 3 year period, unless they're working at least 20 hours a week or involved in a work experience or training program. The state then also implemented staggered issuance, loading benefits from the first to the 20th of the month, which has been very disruptive for persons with limited mobility or a lack of transportation.
Why do they do that?
It was to help retailers better manage their inventories as well as their staffing. But I think that was a really clear indication to us that the economy was going in the wrong direction. But let me make a point here. Mm-hmm. At the same time that we have removed nearly 130,000 Ohioans from the first line of defense, the food stamp program, we've added 500,000 people to the Medicaid program. Medicaid has a higher income eligibility threshold than the food stamp program. So we're starting to see a pretty significant disconnect of other public benefit programs. And this is following really, there is no safety net left. Let me just be clear about this. Welfare reform that this country implemented in 1996 shredded any safety net for vulnerable families and their children. And what we have left now is a food stamp program that's woefully inadequate. Food stamp recipients in the state of Ohio have lost nearly $492 million in 100% federally funded food stamp benefits in 20 months.
Is the state foregoing federal benefits that we could have? Or is this something the state's done to cut the budget for the state?
Well, the first thing I need to say is that the magnitude of the cuts began because of acts of Congress to roll back this modest mm-hmm. boost. At the same time, we were seeing rapidly rising food costs. In fact, food costs are up 10%. But the state did forego a waiver of areas of high unemployment and labor surplus areas to extend food stamp benefits to certain populations. Mm-hmm. And that really has created this impact of removing over 100,000 of the poorest of the poor from the program.
Because the state didn't take them up on implementing the waiver.
That's correct.
They didn't request the waiver.
That's correct. And they also did not prioritize employment and training programs for this population. Mm-hmm. And they have many barriers. While the definition or the description of this population are able-bodied adults without dependents, our research of over 4,000 in Franklin County found that they are neither able-minded nor able-bodied.
Alicia Coleman-Jensen, just before I let you go, I wanted to ask you about the graph I saw in the report summary. It looks like we've hit a plateau, whereas the economy has improved in the last year. You don't see, you know, it looks like it's been sort of the same as it's been since about 2009 or 10.
Right. So in our report, we found that food insecurity is down significantly from the peak in 2011. In 2011, 14.9% of U.S. households were food insecure, and now we see it's 14.0%. So we are down from that peak in 2011, but we didn't see a change from 2012 or 2013 to 2014. And a couple of issues Lisa just raised. One is higher food prices. Mm-hmm. We've done some research at the Economic Research Service to look at the relationship between unemployment, food prices, and overall inflation. And we found that while unemployment has gone down since the recession ended, increases in food prices and overall inflation have offset those improvements in unemployment. So if we had only seen a decline in unemployment, we may have seen a decline in food insecurity as well, or a greater decline in food insecurity. But that change in unemployment was offset by higher prices. And we've found in other research that variation in local food prices is really important to food insecurity rates. So those higher food prices appear to be a factor in these stagnant food insecurity rates. And as well, the point that Lisa brought up about the termination of the stimulus and bump up at SNAP benefits in November 13 may also be reflected in this data, that while food prices were increasing, SNAP households saw a decline in their benefits. So those factors might be related to these really stagnant food insecurity rates in the last couple of years.
Well, Alicia Coleman-Jensen, thanks so much for joining us. I appreciate your time today.
Thanks for having me.
Alicia Coleman-Jensen is the lead author of a new report from the United States Department of Agriculture. It's entitled Household Food Security in the United States in 2014. Ohio did not rank well. In fact, it was one of the top three worst in the country. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. We'll continue. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Last week, the United States Department of Agriculture gave Ohio the dubious distinction of ranking just behind Arkansas and Missouri as the state with the third highest percentage of families with very low food security. That is, they skimp or skip meals to make ends meet. We just heard from one of the co-authors of the report. We have a link to that at our website at wosu.org/allsides. Still with us is Executive Director of the Ohio Association of Food Banks, Lisa Hamler-Fugit. Joining us now is President and CEO of the Mid-Ohio Food Bank, Matt Habash. Welcome back, Matt.
Thank you. Welcome. Glad to be here.
When you started with the food bank in 1984, it was giving out 3 million pounds of food a week, which seems like so much. Now you're almost at 60 million pounds of food. Is that a week?
No, it's a year.
It's a year.
Those are annualized numbers.
But still, of course, Central Ohio is much more populous now, right? And I was wondering how you suss out what's what from the growth in the population and from the increasing rates of poverty.
Well, I start by saying that, you know, when I started in 1984, if you find the original article that was announcing I was taking the job, I said my goal was to go out of business.
Right.
And so going from 3 million pounds to almost 60 million pounds, you know, annually is failure at my one goal in life, was to really put food banks out of business. And we shouldn't be here in today's society. We ought to be able to figure out there's enough food, there's enough resources in America that we should not even have to exist. So it's in that context that I really look at all of this, is just continue decline, as Lisa had mentioned in the earlier segment, you know, around the issue that, you know, the safety net is gone. And I think it's a reality. And food costs continue to increase. We don't think, most of us don't think about that. You know, the price of chicken and eggs go up, and we moan and groan. But the reality is, if you're on a fixed income, particularly if you're on a food stamp budget, you know, that has a huge impact when you can't buy that kind of protein for yourself or your family.
What do you hear from the people you serve to explain the increase in the number of people who have very low food security in Ohio, despite what we often hear about how the economy is so much better, how there are so many more jobs?
Well, I think the reality of it is most of the people we're helping now are working. You know, that's a huge shift in our, you know, from
that
my early
days. That wasn't the case in 84?
84 was definitely not the case. You know, the people were not working. We were dealing with the folks that couldn't work. You know, in today's, you know, what we see now is a lot of people who are living right on the edge. They're one incident away from stepping into needing help at any given time. You all think about our own budgets every time we have a blip in our budget. You know, it has an impact on us. Well, if you don't have any resources to meet that particular incident, then you're going to turn to a food pantry to get assistance. And that's what's been happening over all these years. It's continually more and more people. Most amazing statistic in our data system is 80% of our clients come five times or less a year. So this whole myth about people get food and they just come back and they want to come back, get something free, is absolutely not true. These are people living on the edge, trying to survive, trying to do all things right.
Avoiding going to the food bank at all costs.
Going to a pantry. I mean, they don't want to go to a pantry, you know, so we're trying to figure out. But I'm also equally concerned about what they're eating. Mm-hmm. When you think about the fact that, you know, that obesity issues are on a rise, which is often a disconnect for people, mm-hmm. you know, the reality of it is it's the cheapest food is not the healthiest food in America. It's the most expensive food, and we're trying to figure out strategies. So we've moved into this whole new model of giving out fresh food. 60% of what we now give out of that 60 million pounds is fresh food.
And back in 1984?
It was probably non-existent.
Practically nothing.
Practically nothing. So we have moved into a whole, what I would call a hunger to health strategy or a food as health strategy, saying the diabetes research, those kind of things that we're doing with this access to fresh food, which is surplus food in this country. The amazing fact is that we've got over 10 billion pounds of produce left in the fields every year in the United States. We're collecting nationally less than 1.4 billion. We've got a huge uptick that we could feed hungry people. And our clients say the only reason they don't consume more of that is they can't afford it at the grocery store.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about food insecurity in Ohio, ranks the third lowest in the country behind Arkansas and Missouri now, according to a United States Department of Agriculture report released last week. If you have a question or comment, I'm talking with Matt Habash. He's president and CEO of the Mid-Ohio Food Bank. Also with us, Lisa Hamler-Fugit of the Ohio Association of Food Banks. Questions, comments, 614-292-8513. James in Clintonville, you're on the air. Hi, James.
Hello. I have a comment. I just want to start out by saying that I'm a professional. I was gainfully employed for 30 years plus. I'm a veteran also, never received any, food assistance of that like. About 2 years ago, I was laid off from my job, which was, I was making well over six figures. And I had no choice but to get on the food stamp program and take advantage of the food banks in Central Ohio. And I also have, you know, a few children, and they were caught up in that mix too. And I kind of want to just build on what the guest said about not wanting to go. It was very humbling, but I was able to use that, not only the food stamps, but the food banks, to get myself and my children through that, you know, bad situation. And now I'm back employed and doing very well. I ended up saving my house. So this notion that, there's people that are on public assistance are somehow lazy or they're not productive citizens is not true in my case.
Let me ask you, James, did you have a different impression before you found yourself in need?
No, quite honestly, I've always been pretty open-minded when it came to that, trying to give back. But it did change. My opinion did change with respect to the people that are on assistance. They're no different than the rest of us, you know. It's just circumstances that put them in that position.
Well, thank you so much for your call, and I'm so happy you saved your house and you're back on the job.
Thank you.
Take care.
All right, bye.
Bye. You can email us as well at allsides@wosu.org. We have an email from Pam. I'd like to hear what you two say about this. She says, as food insecure families are assessed, is there also an assessment of the presence of alcohol and tobacco purchased with earned income rather than used for living costs? What is the more complete story? What are people actually spending money on? So what do we know about that? They're making a living. They may not be making a lot of money. Maybe they're working two or three jobs with no benefits. But they're making money. They're bringing money in. What do we know about what they do spend it on if it's not on food? Lisa Hamler, if you get.
Well, what I can tell you is that food stamps can only be used to purchase food. You cannot purchase personal care, personal hygiene, or household cleaning items. And you certainly cannot purchase alcohol or cigarettes. I think it's always interesting that this is where a lot of folks go to. And believe me, we know from USDA data that the food purchasing patterns of food stamp recipients are really no different than that of the general public. The most fungible portion of anybody's budget is what they have to spend on food. So again, I think what we're hearing again, in some of these questions, it's kind of code that we want to blame the poor for their circumstances. And in fact, what we're seeing, especially individuals like your last caller, James, is that we have more and more Ohioans and families that are caught in this endless cycle of jobs that don't pay nearly enough. And they end up very quickly with little or no income.
The only thing I would add to that, I think in the states that have done some kind of drug testing, they have found very, very, very few people that have actually shown up with drugs in their system. So I think it's a case where, you know, most of those systems would say they spent a lot of money, you know, requiring drug testing, and it did not prove out any point that people were spending their money on drugs or other things in that regard. And I think the other thing to remind is, you know, with the very poorest of the poor is the you know, the statement that's often made by our housing counterparts is they're spending more than 50% of their income on housing. Now, I would submit to any of us, go back and think about your own budget. Mm-hmm. And if you had to put 50% of the money, what would you be adjusting in your own budget? And that's happening to these folks every day. And then when you had on the variable cost of food going up, you know, that's the kind of thing you see.
Because it all starts with a place that's safe and secure to live. The housing people would always say that. An email from Wendy. She says, all of my clients are disabled. Most of them had a substantial cut in their food stamps, and I have to rely on the pantry system for at least 1 week a month. This has devastated this population. It is heartbreaking.
Oh, I absolutely agree. I think one of the worst things Congress did was that early sunset of that modest benefit. We also have not had the kind of conversation that we need to have in this country about food is medicine, food is health. And if you look at healthcare spending overall, both at the state and the federal level and in our own budgets, we're spending more and more on healthcare, and it's on clinical or treatment, not on prevention. And if I could wave my magic wand and say, what would I like to see in a new world order? It would be a food stamp benefit that is more reflective of what it actually costs in order to buy a healthy, wholesome diet.
Such as?
As a moderate food program. Right now it's based on the Thrifty Food Plan. Benefits are only meant to be supplemental, meaning that individuals have 30% of their income at which to supplement a Thrifty Food Plan budget. It is not enough. I would like to see physicians being able to write prescriptions for healthy food. Certainly, we know, and Matt's done a lot of research on this, diabetes is one of the leading cost drivers in the healthcare system. Mm-hmm. It is a diet-related disease. And needs to be treated first with healthy, wholesome food, not more insulin or a fistful of prescriptions. But for the disabled, this is penny wise and pound foolish, that if these individuals cannot maintain their independence in a community setting, they are on the fast track to nursing homes. We spend $60,000 a year putting people in nursing homes. And again, for a few hundred dollars a month to allow them to live in their own homes and in their communities, being able to purchase food through normal channels is the right public policy.
Matt Habash, you will be recently opening up the Southside Roots Cafe and Market as part of the new Reeb Avenue Center on the city south side. That's reflecting a new approach to what you've been doing since 1984. It's reflecting more of a long-term need you're settling in.
It is, and on a couple of fronts. One is we really have the opportunity to produce or to sell at very low cost, you know, fresh food, you know, which I think is a challenge, you know, in this country in terms of getting healthy, fresh food to people.
Where people are living,
right in the community on the south side of Reeb and Parsons, you know, and to have the ability, we're not competing with the grocery store. There's a Kroger, you know, not very far away. It's a case of how do we get a lower cost product into people's hands, but also the idea of partnering. There's a fairly qualified health center on that campus. There's senior citizens that have new housing on that campus. You know, we've got, you know, Girls and Boys Club with after school programs. We've got, you know, a daycare there. So it's an opportunity to make food the focus. To pick up on what Lisa just said, one of our challenges really is we have a food as health strategy, you know, or what I call a hunger to health strategy now. You know, how do we really, you know, come at this differently and getting people so that moms, when they drop their kids off for daycare in the morning, can pick up a smoothie and have a breakfast that's healthy food, you know, or when they pick up their kids at night, you know, can go in and shop for a ready-to-eat meal that they can go home and heat up. Because we forget about the convenience factor of food, too. I mean, you go home and say, yeah, cook all this great stuff and go do all that. Well, you're a single mom with a lot of kids. Try all of us.
Try just being not having a lot of kids.
Yeah, just think about it. I mean, a couple kids, you just think about it in general. We don't think about the, you know, when we go home, we're all tired from working all day, you know, kind of thing. And you know, you got to go home and figure out how to do that, you know. And so there's an opportunity for us to say, how do we use food as a driver? You know, we partnered with some docs in Fairfield County and had a writing produce prescriptions. Only had two no-shows out of 150 people that the doctors referred to a produce market, the free produce market that we had. That's unheard of in their world. They can't get people to fill prescriptions because of the cost. But they show up for the food. They showed up to get the food. And if we can make the connection between food and health strategies, that's what we're trying to create those touch points for the health community to think about how does healthy food play a role. We all know that inherently. We just don't do it. And we've got to figure, we don't make those kind of connections. We think more in terms of medicine and drugs. And so that's a whole new avenue for us in terms of
using, you know, we've been talking about the prices of food, and there's all sorts of efforts afoot that could greatly increase the price of food. It's not necessarily an unintended consequence. It's a known consequence when people are trying to get more organically produced food, all kinds of things that are happening in the food sector. What long term, I mean, that price is only going to keep going up.
Yeah,
that's not a part of the economy as we know it. It's separate
It is. And certainly what we're seeing is as third world countries become second world countries, yeah, you know, they love what we have to eat here. And we're seeing more exports. Certainly, whether you believe in global warming or not, the environment is changing. We work with colleagues all over the nation. We're seeing the prolonged impact of the drought in the West that's creating a rising food cost, especially in the area of fresh fruits and vegetables. We're dealing now with the avian influenza that have really skyrocketed egg prices. And eggs are and have always been a very affordable source of protein. While the avian influenza has not hit Ohio, thank God, we're shipping more eggs.
Right. It's still upward pressure
right
on the price.
And I mean, I don't think I would have ever believed that I would have seen eggs selling for $3.99 a dozen because they're a major staple in our network as well. But again, the pressure is that if wages are stagnant, that people have less to spend on food as food costs are rising. And the economic research report showed that food costs were up nearly 11% in the past 4 years. At the same time, inflation is up 8.6%.
But wages sure as heck
aren't. Wages are not.
Matt Habash, can you stay with us for a few more minutes?
Sure.
Okay. We're going to continue our conversation. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Traditionally, we think of urban and rural poor as those in the most need when it comes to food. A fast-growing segment of the food insecure population, however, resides in the suburbs. Food pantries are responding to the needs. The Worthington Resource Pantry opened its doors in 2008, serving a scant 12 families that year. Last year, some 1,000 families were served by the pantry, which has moved and expanded to meet the demand. Still with us is Executive Director of the Ohio Association of Food Banks, Lisa Hamler-Fugit. Also with us, Matt Habash, President and CEO of the Mid-Ohio Food Bank. And joining us now is the Executive Director of the Worthington Resource Pantry, Jennifer Fralick. Welcome to the show, Jennifer.
Thanks for having me.
Yours is a paid position.
Mm-hmm.
Back in the day, 2008, 7 years ago, it was all volunteer. Now there's 3 paid positions. This is work. It's not extra volunteer hours.
Right, right. I was the first full-time person, and I've been there about 2 years. And in order to meet the need, we really had to grow the capacity. So we had to invest in paid staff and really invest in our infrastructure to meet the increasing demand.
The idea at the time when it opened was to get over the hump of the recession, right? It
mm-hmm.
wasn't intended to be this sort of fixture.
Right, right. We have seen increase in numbers of 20-25% year over year. So it's not going away.
Is that partly because people know about you?
It could be. Definitely in our new location, we have increased visibility. But if you look at the percentage of kids in the school district who are eligible for free and reduced lunch, it hovers around 30%. And in some schools, it's over 50%. Not what you think about in the suburbs, but it's reality.
Matt Habash, I mean, there's been a lot of suburban food pantries opening up around Central Ohio and Lisa Hamler-Fugit, you know, around the state. But that hasn't taken the pressure off you. Have you seen any change?
No, I think actually we're seeing an increase. I think part of this is a realization. I mean, you look across the northern tier suburbs of Franklin County, you don't think about hunger.
Mm-hmm.
Dublin has a very large pantry. We've got the pantry in Worthington. There's actually a couple other pantries in Worthington. And additionally, we've got Warm in Westerville. So if you just go across the northern tier, they're all seeing an increase in the number of people that are coming in. So I think it's a case where it's, you know, when you talk about hunger, it's us, not them. It's our neighbors. It's our friends. It's people with kids go to school with. You know, it's the people working the jobs. And we also had a strategy called the Comprehensive Housing Affordability Strategy, where it was disperse. You know, we don't want the high concentrations of housing anymore, the old projects. And so there was an attempt to disperse the housing around and put them where the job centers were. It was close to jobs, cut the mm-hmm. transportation bill. So there was, some of this was intentional in terms of spreading people out of high concentrations of poverty, but that hasn't explained the growth. The growth is certainly around people struggling to make ends meet.
Hmm. Bryce in Mount Gilead, you're on the air. Hi, Bryce.
Hi, thank you for taking my call, Ann.
Sure.
So I'm running for my local Board of Education in Mount Gilead, and one of the big issues that we have right now is we have over a 50% poverty rate for our children in the school system, and we have a free and reduced lunch program and a free breakfast program, which is greatly used, but we don't have any kind of outside programs such as the Big Brothers, Big Sisters, and our food pantry is having difficulty getting product in. And I'm thinking about dinner programs and weekend programs and summer programs. And I'm just wondering if there are any suggestions that we can take to help curb that issue with hunger in our community, because we know that students don't perform as well in schools when they're hungry.
Absolutely, Bryce. And thank you for your commitment to our child nutrition programs. One is a program, a federal program called the Child and Adult Care Food Program, that can provide you with federal funds to provide snacks and evening meals for children. There's a great opportunity right now. All of our child nutrition programs have to be reauthorized by the end of September at the federal level. We can make massive new investments in these programs. Certainly, we're seeing school-based food pantries beginning all over the state, our backpack programs as well. But again, to raise this, poverty is the issue. And hunger is merely a symptom of poverty. You can't teach hungry children. And this should be a clarion call, not only for the members of your community, our school board, but every elected official at the local, state, and federal level. We can either make the strategic investments to address and end hunger, or all of us will pay the price, including our children. A hungry child cannot learn. They too often grow up to be an adult who cannot earn.
Thanks, Bryce, in Mount Gilead, for that call. I wanted to talk about something he kind of made me think about, maybe what some people are experiencing, Jennifer, in Mount Gilead, is what perhaps Worthington went through a few years ago when it started its food bank. That's them, not us. What did it take to educate the community to embrace this issue as something that affects everybody?
Sure. We consider what we do feeding our neighbors, and it begins with the culture of respect, and that's how we just see everything that we do. And it's sort of like the concept of universal design. So I think it's like, if you think about healthy food is a universal right of everyone. So what we do is we set it up as close as we can to mimic a grocery store. And that way our volunteers, through interacting, can see, hey, this, I know these people. They're my neighbors. I'm feeding my neighbors. And but I'm not going to lie. We do struggle a lot with us versus them in the community. We also struggle with people failing to believe that we need this kind of program in Worthington. So we still have a lot of work to do. But I think with the awareness, and really we rely heavily on volunteers, and they are sending the message to their community that it's everyone.
When someone walks into the food pantry for the first time, what happens?
Sure. Well, they're greeted, and we do a brief intake process to make sure that they meet the income and eligibility requirements. And then they're taken with a volunteer, kind of a personal shopper, through our Choice food pantry. And they get 3 days worth of food. And we try, because we're a partner agency of Mid-Ohio Food Bank, we're able to match that 60% fresh because they provide us with what we have. So, you know, they really get some healthy food, lots of fresh produce, and through the they also get meat as well and bread.
Well, you know, I wanted to talk about an issue regarding the fresh produce, the fresh meats, you know, the proteins that are so important. That really raises the cost of what you do, doesn't it, Matt Habash? I mean, it's expensive to keep fresh food, isn't it?
It's about 17 cents a pound for us to bring in produce into, you know, so, you know, in the old days of dry packaged goods, we were getting that stuff for free, you know, and we just had a transportation bill. So, you know, transportation's probably about 10 cents out of that 17 cents. So we're paying some picking and packing costs with the farmers, which is what we want to do. We want to encourage them to, you know, we don't want a farmer having to absorb the cost. But at the same time, it costs me, if we go out and buy canned goods in a grocery store, the old operation feed ideas, when we go out and buy, it's 50 to 75 cents a pound. So we're the opposite of the grocery store. Getting produce into our model, and we don't charge the pantries for any of this. They get it for free. Mm-hmm. So it's on us to raise the money to bring it in. But the idea is we can actually bring in healthier food, but we also have revamped our logistics. So no produce is in my building more than 48 hours.
Okay.
It literally comes in, cross docks, goes right back out. We have these wonderful partners that can absorb it. And then we've gone to 1,000 produce markets. These are free markets, usually about 10,000 pounds at a time. So we can get 10,000 pounds of produce out to the community in about 2 hours. That's the fastest. And this stuff was in a farm a couple of days before that. So that's the beauty of shifting our model. And then we've got, you know, wonderful partners that are able to keep a steady supply there. And we're coming up with all kinds of strategies to get it there on a just-in-time, fresh basis. So it's forced the food bank to rethink our modeling in terms of logistics. But if the partners can help us handle it, you know, and we've got these great markets, we're figuring out strategies to get it in people's hands very fresh and very quickly.
I have an email from Jay who writes, I am the kind of person that feels shame that I have to go to a food pantry because there's not enough money to go around. I work a job that is considered an individual contractor, and I don't make the money that you would assume. I barely make more than a dollar above the minimum wage, yet I work at least 50 to 55 hours a week every week. This is whether I'm sick or not, because I can't afford to be sick because bills don't get paid. This is not something that should be a normal practice. And to piggyback on that, Pat from Upper Arlington, you're on the air. Hi, Pat.
Yes, I think that this whole thing does stem from the minimum wage, which there's an editorial in today's paper that touts the fact that we have $8.10 an hour as our minimum wage, which produces about $16,000 to $17,000 a year if you work full-time. I think that's disgraceful, and I don't know what Kasich would say about that, because he's always bragging about Ohio and how well Ohio's doing. Now that we're ranked so low on the scale as far as people having to access food banks, I just wonder what he would say about it. And then in the meanwhile, the inheritance tax of all the rich people, we decided to repeal the inheritance tax in Ohio. So it just doesn't make sense to me. I think people, I don't care if people have to cut. I don't care about Walmart. I refuse to shop in that place. So I know that maybe some hours are going to be cut, but all in all, the really manufacturing jobs that paid a lot of money are the ones that left our country, as we know, during this big recession we had. And what is left are low-paying jobs. And I think it's a disgrace. So if people were just paid more an hour, I think our problem would be solved.
Okay.
That's what I have to say.
Thank you, Pat, for
Thank
your call.
You.
I want to agree with both Pat and Jay. And what Pat described is really what we see. It's the paycheck to the food pantry, where hunger in working America, people aren't making enough to be able to stand in grocery store checkout lines. Instead, they're forced to stand in food pantry lines. You know, we need sound and effective public policy. A minimum wage is not a livable wage. We need corporate leadership. And I want to say that we've had an example of that. We need more corporations stepping up like Nationwide Insurance did and said that, you know, our starting wage is $15 an hour. Those are jobs with benefits and opportunity for health insurance, paid time off, and to save towards retirement. And again, it also needs to be about tax reform, a comprehensive tax reform where if wages aren't going to come up, then we need things like enhancements of the federal earned income tax credit. We have been lobbying Governor Kasich to do a refundable earned income tax credit here at the state that ensures that low-income working families are going to receive that benefit of a tax refund. But again, it needs to be all of these together. But we need to have corporations with some real skin in the game. And for us, all of us, we need to really start to push back when others want to frame this as a lack of personal responsibility. There are very powerful and ever-changing structural forces at play here.
Right. Over the years since 1984, Matt Habash, when you got into the business of feeding people who can't afford to feed themselves, lots changed.
Very much so. I think that the idea that people are working and having to use a food pantry is probably, you know, actually a disgrace for America. You know, when we're working, playing by all the rules, you shouldn't have to use a food pantry to get by. And I think that's a change. So we took a stand ourselves. I mean, the food bank last September raised our wages to $15 an hour for anybody that works for us. And the amazing thing is it didn't cost us a lot more money. At least saved all kinds of money in turnover and training costs and all kinds of ways that, you know, in essence, we broke even by the, you know, in the year. So I think it's a case where it can be done. We just have got to quit getting out of the soundbite answers to some of these questions sometimes. We think we've got a simple solution to a very complex problem. There's a lot of solutions to this. And Lisa's right. The corporate community, I tell them, you can lead the way, or you're going to get legislated at some point. It's the reality of what has to happen. I mean, we all grew up in those industrial age jobs. And jobs are going to get lost to technology. But that's another excuse that's coming up. We're just going to switch to iPads instead of people working. We've always done technology. We lost more manufacturing jobs to technology than we did to overseas, you know, kind of transport. But we don't understand that. So those are the challenges. And I think we've got to literally all come together and be willing to be engaged in a new and unique conversation.
Well, I imagine the conversation will continue. I appreciate you joining us today. Lisa Hamler-Fugit, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Ann.
Lisa Hamler-Fugit, she's Executive Director of the Ohio Association of Food Banks. And also Matt Habash, thanks to you as well for joining us.
Thank you.
Matt Habash, President and CEO of the Mid-Ohio Food Bank. And Jennifer Fralick, Executive Director of the Worthington Resource Pantry. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening. And thanks to the Allside staff, producer Michael DeBonis, associate producer Amy Jurovich, assistant producer Shyla Knott, Allside's interns, Trent Lammers, Ryan McFadden, and Sydney Schaefer, with video production by Rich Karsmitsky and Amber Karsmitsky. Thanks again for listening. This is Allside's with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.